Wyoming Catholic College academic dean, Dr. Thaddeus Kaczynski, while writing his dissertation, made money on the side by tutoring. One day, he arrived at the home of his students to find all the literature books in the library replaced by the lives of the saints. "Mr. Kaczynski," said his employer, "I realized last night that all that matters is my children's salvation, that we are saved by being good Christians, and that the best Christians are the saints. So they should be reading their lives, not Charles Dickens, and presumably not Plato either." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for these After Dinner Scholar podcasts. Earlier this month, Dr. Kaczynski told that story to introduce a lecture he delivered to our entire student body, faculty, staff, and guests from the town of Lander. The title of his lecture posed a question: is reading Plato necessary for salvation? And his answer to the question may surprise you. Dr. Kaczynski is our guest on this edition of the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Kaczynski, on the one hand, reading nothing but the Bible and the lives of the saints makes sense. Salvation is the most important thing there is. But on the other hand, that doesn't seem quite right. What is it that's not quite right and why?
In a nutshell, or in short, grace, the supernatural, faith, God is not all there is. There's creation, there's nature, there's reason, there's human faculties that are presupposed in the life of grace and salvation. There are answers that are given by, through the Bible and church teaching, to questions that come from our very existence as creatures in the world. And grace perfects nature, which is a Thomistic dogma. Grace builds upon nature. Grace presupposes nature. And so a liberal education and formation in the human powers, the better that formation is, the more comprehensive and profound the experiences we have in the world, the more there is, you might say, to be saved. You might say the ego, or the sort of self that we're supposed to lose in order to find God, needs to be as developed as possible. Insofar as with a fully developed self, we can give that self away. There's more to give. And so those are all kind of quick reasons for why you might just say grace isn't sufficient for salvation in a paradoxical way, only because grace presupposes something that grace itself is building upon and saving.
And works of liberal arts create that something.
Yeah, you could say that the liberal arts basically form the human, the soul. The soul is perfected and brought into the supernatural order, the order of caritas, and the infused virtues, faith, hope, and love, are what saves us. But what are those infused virtues infused into? They're infused into, hopefully, a fully developed, virtuous, and formed, educated soul.
In your lecture, you said, "Our present culture is, among all the myriad descriptions one could give it, anti-logos rather than simply anti-Christian." What does it mean to be anti-logos? How does that affect the way we hear the gospel? And how does Plato help us to become not anti-logos? Mm-hmm.
So the word logos, if you looked at a lexicon, and you would find pages and pages of different explanations of the meaning of that word: reason, argument, rationality, order. But logos basically is the image of God on earth in creation, in terms of the whole. So the whole order of the cosmos, in a sense, is pervaded by logos. Jesus Christ is the logos. That's the word for Greek word for word, verbum in Latin. And St. John calls the second person of the Blessed Trinity the incarnate logos. He is the divine logos, through whom and in the image of whom the created logos is. Our culture, by rejecting the divine economy, in its structure, in its laws, in its customs, insofar as you have a culture ordered towards man's desires, towards man's will, a culture that is ordered not to conforming desire to truth, to goodness, to beauty, the transcendentals of being, which is another way to talk about logos. Instead, we have a culture which tries to conform the logos to our human desires. We think this is progress. This is humanism. This is the apotheosis of the human. Human flourishing somehow requires us to be autonomous, to create our own values, to be able to be free as much as possible from any order that isn't authored by us. In that sense, it's a culture of anti-logos. This logos that by which the world is patterned, in which it's patterned, doesn't force itself upon us. It's there for us to, it invites us to it to adore and to get to know and to love. But it isn't a totalitarian thing. It is an unchanging and impervious order. We can't really change this order through our human will. It's a metaphysical order. It's beyond the physical world, spiritual, metaphysical. It manifests itself in the physical order of things. But ultimately, we can't, for instance, change the moral aspect of this logos. We can't make things that are beautiful not to be beautiful. Beauty exists outside of our will and our thoughts. Our thoughts and imaginations and our souls are meant to conform to this order, but we do this freely. So the best cultures would be one that provides an ability to apprehend this good, one might say, in the ethical realm, and to freely conform to it. Invites us to do that, helps us to do that the most easily. The worst culture will be one that makes this logos, you know, invisible to us or even antagonistic. We perceive it as some a threat to our freedom and our flourishing. And that's more or less where our culture, insofar as it's rejecting God, even if it's just practical atheism, leads us. Gender is a good example of this. Gender is an aspect of the logos, the order of human sexuality. To say that this is something that we create and construct and can manipulate and change is an anti-logos idea, and that's, of course, embodied in law now. Plato, his whole project was really to get the readers of his dialogues and those students at his school to have an acquaintance, a deeper and deeper acquaintance and obedience to and love of this order of things, something he called the good and the world of form, and to love this above all for the sake of our souls. So in that sense, Plato is the enemy of the enemies of logos.
Talk to us about what you call the death of questioning. You only mentioned that, but it really caught my attention.
Sure. Alistair MacIntyre has a quote where he says that our culture is one of answers without questions. And what he means by this is, whether you are more inclined to the left of the political spectrum or the right, there's a sense in which we have a kind of it's an ideological culture. So ideology doesn't permit questions, whether it's Marxist ideology on the left or a kind of capitalist ideology, consumer capitalist ideology on the right, fascism on the right, communism on the left. An ideology is a kind of second structure of reality that cloaks the true order of things, and which is a reductionistic view. And it has all the answers to life. It tells us exactly what class and race and gender on the one hand, what authority should be, the role of the state. It tells us in terms of scientific ideology that nothing else is there but matter. All it takes to see through ideology and to recognize its counterfeit sort of nature, its inability to really explain anything, because ultimately it's an expression of human will imposing itself on a complex and mysterious reality to make it controllable and amenable to human desire, All it takes is one question, to question it, to inquire about it, to say, is this the truth? That's a threat to ideology. And insofar as our culture is ideological, it does its best to prevent such inquiry, to privatize it, to make it meaningless. One is allowed to sort of ask whatever questions you want, but those questions have to be seen as having no definitive answer, for instance. The only definitive answers are given to us by the experts who kind of rule us. And that's what I think McIntyre is getting at. The biggest example of this, of course, is ethics. Questioning and inquiring about whether something is good or right is meaningless and futile if it's already been decided that moral expression is nothing but emotions or preferences. It's not an expression describing a moral order that one can know, like the order of mathematics. And so in that sense, the death of moral questioning and the kind of manifestation of that in the dictatorship of moral relativism, as Pope Emeritus called it, that paradoxical expression really sums it up: the dictatorship of relativism. Relativism is supposed to be the freedom of inquiry about morality, but it's a dictatorship with only answers and no questions, because inquiry is really not permitted.
Several times in the lecture, you use the words courage or cowardice. How are we cowardly, and how does Plato help us to be courageous?
So what I'm talking about in using the word courage here is not so much physical courage, although it's related, or emotional courage, you know, the ability to sort of overcome one's fear, to go towards a difficult good and achieve it. I'm talking about something I call metaphysical courage or spiritual courage. And I guess the best way to put this is a moderately fearless openness to all reality. We tend to be uncomfortable with ideas, practices, mindsets that threaten the paradigm that we presently accept, a constellation of ideas about reality. You know, we all need to have a paradigm. We all need to have a way of ordering the world, of structuring it in our mind. We need to, in a way, impose order in some sense on our everyday lives. And there's nothing inherently cowardly about that. But if that order that we impose through our concepts and ideas and prejudices, our mindset, if that is closing us off to certain aspects of reality that we need to see and we need to accept to stretch ourselves, to make us more alive, to have more being, to flourish, because we're more comfortable with the order we know than the so-called disorder we don't know, that could be based on a lack of courage to embrace reality as it is. And that could be an obstacle to spiritual growth and to hearing what reality has to teach us. So in short, you know, we need to be open to being courageously, and not simply the being that is filtered through our conceptual apparatus, especially if that apparatus is closing us off to the deeper, more profound, more challenging aspects of reality. We just read Crime and Punishment in Humanities, and Raskolnikov, the main character, is taken on a journey from a kind of isolated, alienated man stuck in his own nihilistic concepts. He ends up murdering somebody because of this. And Dostoevsky takes us on a journey where he keeps facing the truth of this, running away, facing it, running away, until he finally submits. And he's given a kind of newfound freedom at the end. And he's taken out of this prison he's caused by his own ideological thinking. So he's taken from metaphysical cowardice to metaphysical courage, and that leads to his salvation. So it's a really good example of what I'm talking about.
If our listeners have never read a Platonic dialogue, what should they start with?
Probably the Apology, which isn't so much a dialogue as it is a speech. It's Socrates' speech he gives to the jury who are voting to whether to execute him, to condemn him or execute him for so-called impiety and corrupting the youth. You get a really good, amazing depiction of this person, Socrates, who is sort of like the embodiment of this kind of metaphysical courage and relentless inquiry into being. One sees in the way in which such a person can't really fit into a culture that's based on power and prestige and right opinion. Again, answers without questions. He dared to question things that needed to be questioned, not for the sake of undermining or subverting the culture of Greece, but to bring it to its real self, its real goodness, its real potential. You know, he was basically executed for this. And then after that, I would say the Euthyphro, these early dialogues of Plato are good beginning points. Euthyphro, the Meno, the Crito, the Phaedo, I would say, is then the next step, a longer dialogue about the immortality of the soul. And that shows Socrates' death. It shows how dignified and beautiful he accepts his own death, knowing that there's more to life than the mere bodily existence. And when you've got through those earlier dialogues, it's time for the Republic. And that's my favorite. I think the Republic is one of the greatest works ever written, and that gives you everything, really. You could start with the Republic if you want to. You could try that. But maybe you need a little appetizer with the other earlier, shorter dialogues.
Good. Well, thank you very much. If you've been intrigued by this interview and you'd like to hear more, let me make two suggestions. The first is to listen to Dr. Kaczynski's entire lecture, which we've made available as a podcast. The second is to come to Lander this June 10th to 14th for the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. Our theme is courage, and Dr. Kaczynski will be one of our faculty members for the school. For more information, please visit our website, wyomingcatholic.org. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.